This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
It's 6 minutes past the hour of six. I'm Howard Feldman. A very, very good evening to you. Joining me in studio, as always, is Dr. Anton Myberg. Tonight, we're talking about the part of health that nobody enjoys discussing. As if we enjoy discussing other things. Well, actually, I do, so still. That's not the point. But gut symptoms are common. They are confusing, and we often brush them off. Sometimes, however, they are the first sign of something serious. This evening, on the Weekly Checkup with Dr. Anton Myberg and me, Howard Feldman, we're unpacking inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, the things with all of the IBSs and the I...
All the artises.
I was just going to say, there's a gastritis, ulcers, H. pylori, Barrett's. Like, there is a lot to talk about. We're going to be talking about practical questions, when to do a scope, when not to, and we'll try and answer all of your questions as well. How do you send me your questions? Well, it's actually pretty simple, and you know the answer to it. 061-895-1019. Thank you for joining us this week on the Weekly Checkup. Anton Myberg, welcome. How are you doing?
Good, and you? Missed you last week.
Yes. Last week was Purim,
right? Sorry you cancelled the show, but we'll try not to do that again.
Well, there I was, drunken in the gutter, as always. So, before we start about this, can I just throw it completely off course, because you know I get hysterical about these things. The smell and sulfur and pollution in the air, when I think about it, I get a bit of an itch in my back of my throat. Seriously, people who are asthmatic, is there any advice you want to give them on this?
So, just be aware of it, but don't be foolishly sort of under threat from it. In other words, we know that the companies, the coal companies, convert their coals into liquid fuels, and they call that process gasification.
Right.
And that creates large amounts of hydrogen sulfide as a routine byproduct. Mm. And when that's released into the air, all that smoke that disperses into the air can affect your lungs, it can affect your nasal passages, it can irritate your eyes, your nose, your throat, can cause headaches, can cause nausea, all that type of thing. So it's mainly for most vulnerable people, it's like elderly people or severe asthmatics. If the levels are very high, it can affect you. But at this current time, it shouldn't really.
Okay. So thank you for that. I feel a little bit more reassured. Well, for the time being, let's talk about gut health. People sometimes say, my stomach is a mess. But that can mean 20 different things. Is there a simple way to divide gut problems?
Yeah. So we can use the real estate mantra. If you've got the right spot, you've got the right golden location.
Location.
So we look at location, mm-hmm. and that we divide the upper gut versus the lower gut, mm-hmm. and that tells you where the trouble is. So if you look at the upper gut, that we're talking about the esophagus, that's your food pipe, and the stomach. And that also affects the first part of your intestines, your small intestines. And the most common symptoms people present with are heartburn, nausea, vomiting, upper abdominal pain, early fullness and burping. The most common conditions we've seen that is gastroesophageal reflux disease, acid reflux, or gastritis, inflammation of the stomach ulcers, and more common today, gastroparesis. Where I say more common is that people who are on the GLP-1 medications. And then we can divide into the lower gut problems, which is the intestine per se, and that affects the small and the large intestine, the colon, the rectum, and the anus. Your common symptoms there are diarrhea, constipation, rectal bleeding, low abdominal pain, bloating, and your common conditions we're going to talk about are irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, which is broken up into ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. That's your first part of how to break it up. That's your location. And then you break it into something called functional versus inflammatory. Mm. And the functional versus inflammatory is the cause.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. It is 10 minutes past the hour of 6. We're going to take a quick break. I'm chatting to Dr. Anton Myberg. We'll be back straight after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 11 minutes past the hour of 6. I'm chatting to Dr. Anton Myberg. We're talking gut health tonight. Mavis, thank you. I see your message and your question. We are going to come to it. But in the meantime, but before we do that, we just wanted to cover some of the larger areas. Anton, we were talking about functional versus inflammation.
So can you just give me an understanding of what that is? We just spoke about location, where you find the problem in the colon or in the gut or in the stomach. Now we're talking about what is the cause. So when we say is it functional, the gut in a functional problem looks structurally normal, and we see that on a scan or a scope, but does not function correctly. Okay. And the issue is how the gut moves, how it communicates with the brain, or how sensitive it is. And the most common symptoms of that is chronic fluctuating pain, bloating, alternating bowel habits. And we see this in conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or functional dyspepsia, which is chronic indigestion. And the drivers for this are things like stress, anxiety, diet, and you get what we call gut-brain communication issues. And then the inflammatory side of it, is it damaged or is it diseased? And there's visible damage on your scopes or your scans, where there are ulcers, there are sores, and these are normally accompanied by the red flags, whether there's bleeding in the stools, whether there's severe diarrhea. And the examples of this are your inflammatory bowel disease, your ulcerative colitis, or your Crohn's disease. And your drivers for this are very different to your functional causes, because this is an immune system dysfunction.
Okay. IBS. Is that, I always understood that IBS was just a name that doctors gave something they couldn't know, that they couldn't identify.
So, no. So IBS is exactly what we just described. Now, that's a functional problem. It's a functional issue where the gut actually looks normal, but for lack of better terms, behaves poorly. So it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. So it's a disorder, not a disease, and it's called the gut-brain issue. Mm-hmm. Where your digestive tract doesn't function properly. So your intestines look absolutely normal on a scan, but they're sensitive and react to stress or diet with cramping. You get cramping, you get bloating, you get gas and diarrhea and constipation, and it can become very severe. You can become very uncomfortable. It can impact the quality of your life, but it doesn't cause any permanent damage to your intestines. Doesn't cause cancer,
it's just
and doesn't require surgery.
It's just very unpleasant to live with.
Very unpleasant thing to live
okay,
with.
Okay, fine. And can it come and then still go without ever really identifying what the cause of it was?
Definitely. I mean, you generally have to do a few things to work out what the cause of these things are, but you can just have inflammatory bowel disease, which is a chronic thing, or you can have irritable bowel, which comes and goes sporadically.
Okay. Got it. Right. If you want to share a symptom with us, please do so. WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. What symptom is your main issue? Is it pain, bloating, reflux, diarrhea, constipation, blood, nausea? These are some of the common ailments. And before we move, we start to move on around this, Mavis says, sometimes when I swallow food, it seems that the food gets stuck in my esophagus and I can't swallow even my saliva for around 20 minutes. Does that indicate something?
So yes, it does. I mean, that's not normal. Right. If something's not normal, there's definitely something going on. Now, that definitely doesn't sound like it's your functional side. It sounds like there's some issue going on there, whether or not there's a narrowing of the esophagus, whether or not there's a blockage in the esophagus, whether or not it's a neurological cause for things like Parkinson's or myasthenia gravis. There's all different causes that can do that, whether or not, worst case scenario, it's a cancer yeah. of the esophagus and you can't swallow. You get an apple core narrowing of the esophagus, or you get an apple core narrowing down lower in the intestines.
Okay, can we not these work Mavis upright now?
So Mavis, you ask a question, you get an answer.
I guess that is why she asked the
sometimes
question.
When you can't swallow foods and they get stuck there, you've got to realize something is wrong and you need to be attended to.
Okay, so she needs to look into this.
Yeah.
Right, I'm very pleased that Carol asked this question because I wanted to and I was too embarrassed.
What?
Mavis says it only happens occasionally, but there's probably something still worth looking into.
Go to your local gastroenterologist.
Right. My daughter is 50 and she's been diagnosed with a hiatus hernia and suffers terrible inflammation in the stomach. Any advice from the doctor? So the reason I wanted Carol to ask that, well, somebody to ask the question, is the only person I ever knew with a hiatus hernia was my late grandmother. So I thought, Carol, that this was something from Eastern European old ladies made up. But because I've never heard of it from anyone else. Is it a real thing?
Hiatus hernia is a very real thing.
Right.
I see a lot of my patients that come presenting with hiatus hernia.
What is it?
You pick it up on an x-ray or you pick it up through their symptomatology. It occurs when your upper part of your stomach pushes up into your chest cavity, and that's through a small opening, which is called hiatus, in the diaphragm.
Right.
The diaphragm is a muscle that separates the abdomen from the chest.
Mm.
Majority of time causing no symptoms. But it often causes acid reflux, heartburn, chest pain, and difficulty swallowing. And there are different types. There's something called a peristophageal hernia. There's a sliding hiatus hernia. They're all different, and they all can cause different issues. But as I say, the majority of them don't cause issues.
Right. Is that why my late grandmother would sleep sitting up, basically?
May she rest in peace, yes.
May she rest in peace. She never rested in peace. That's what she said.
So that falls under the diagnosis of gastroesophageal reflux disease, which I think I'd like to discuss later and explain to you what the whole purpose of sitting up is and why people do that.
Okay, that's brilliant. Carol, thank you for that nudge in the right direction. Right, let's talk about Crohn's versus... let's talk about Crohn's versus ulcerative colitis.
Okay, so now we're on to the inflammatory bowel diseases. Okay?
Right.
And they are two very different diseases. Okay.
Right.
So Crohn's is a disease that affects the whole digestive tract from the mouth until the anus.
Right.
It goes all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
It inflames areas of the intestinal walls. It causes very obvious things called patches that damage the outer lining of the intestines.
Okay.
And people with disease can experience diarrhea, they can get mouth sores, as well as malnutrition. So the complications
really?
Can be very serious because they get malnutrition because it affects a certain area in the colon called the terminal ileum where foods are absorbed. You get a lot of these people with a low vitamin B12 level. These things control the symptoms and help people live active lives. And if you aren't absorbing nutrients, then you have problems with this. So the inflammation from the Crohn's causes the walls of the intestines to thicken, and then it makes the affected areas crack, and they form tunnels, and they can actually form passageways in the intestinal walls, and therefore you get the malnutrition and you get these things happening. Now, your disease for Crohn's presents very differently to ulcerative colitis because the major symptoms here is diarrhea that is usually not bloody, malnutrition, because of that digestive tract that doesn't absorb the food, and mouth sores, as you said, because it involves the whole digestive tract from the mouth until the anus. And your symptoms can be severe. You can get complications. You get ulcers. You get open sores in the mouth. You can get anal fissures. You can get fistulas and abscesses. Now, abscesses happen when an area is damaged by inflammation, and then you get pus forming pockets in the intestines, which become swollen and painful and can perforate. You can get a fistula, which is a very common thing in Crohn's disease. This happens when the ulcer extends through the actual intestinal wall and creates a painful abnormal passageway when it connects with another organ. So you can get visible fluid draining out of that organ. You can have infections filled with pus, which become abscesses. You can have it going onto the skin. And then you get your strictures and obstruction. And strictures are narrowing of the intestinal wall and cause an obstruction. So a lot of these patients who develop at this stage will need surgery to relieve the stricture so that the colon can
When does Crohn's normally present? Is there an age?
So there is an age for Crohn's presenting. And it's normally in your below 30s or above 50s to 60s.
Right. And do we understand the cause?
So it's a chronic autoimmune disease where your immune system attacks the intestines and it causes inflammation and sores. And it causes structural, physical damage to the bowel wall and with those key symptoms. And it's a lifelong condition. It's not a condition that you can cure, but you can treat them quite effectively in the 2026s now.
We're going to hold it right there for just one moment. It is a 6:21. We'll be back with you just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 6:22. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup. So have you ever thought if you, you know, if medicine just doesn't work out, to become a voice artist?
Well, that's why I did it. I thought, like, you know, let's take it a different level. Let's push my colon through its through the ranks there and see how much I can talk.
Can we dispense with that type of imagery, if you know what I mean? Okay, so let's talk about, that's Crohn's. What is colitis then?
So that's the second part of inflammatory bowel disease. That's called ulcerative colitis, and that's the most common type of the inflammatory bowel diseases. That affects the inner lining of the colon and the rectum, which causes complete damage to the lining. And the difference is people with ulcerative colitis often experience blood or mucus in their stools, and they feel an urgent need to empty their bowels. So the inflammation causes the colon to weaken, and then this wears away the affected areas of the colon, creating open sores called ulcers. So it affects the large intestines from the rectum through to the colon, and it only affects the inner lining. And as I said, the symptoms are very much more of that of blood or mucus in the stools, stomach cramping when you have a bowel movement, or an urgent need to have a bowel movement. The severity comes, and this is the difference between that also with Crohn's, is you can get what we call a fulminant ulcerative colitis, where that's a very rare form of the disease, but it's extremely severe symptoms and requires urgent treatment. You have to really worry about the complications from ulcerative colitis because people can present with severe dehydration because the colon doesn't have the ability to absorb water anymore from the fluid loss due to the frequent trips to the bathroom. You get severe blood from the rectum, and that's due to the ulcers causing blood to pass through the anus during bowel movements. You can become anemic, perforations of the colon, and then the most serious is what we call a toxic megacolon, when the inflammation spreads completely through the deep tissue of the intestines, causing the inflammation to sever the colon and stop it from working.
So how are they diagnosed, Crohn's and colitis?
So there's many ways to diagnose them, and you've got to look at the pain pattern, what type of diarrhea, is there weight loss, is there fatigue, is there fever. Generally, they're diagnosed by a stool test called a fecal calprotectin, okay, which is a test which it shows a high level in inflammatory bowel disease. And that's one of the defining factors between inflammatory bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome, that someone with irritable bowel syndrome, first of all, they won't generally have blood in their stools, but they'll have a low level of fecal calprotectin, right, where someone with an inflammatory bowel disease will have a very high level. And then it's done on endoscopy, whether it's colonoscopy together with gastroscopy. Those are the most common ways to pick up this disease.
Unsign says, hi, could you please ask the doctor why one gets heart palpitations with a hiatus hernia on the left side of the body and if this needs to be attended to?
That's a great question. So I think we've got to understand why it's called heartburn. So the stomach is lined by a nerve called the vagus nerve. It wraps around the stomach, goes up the left side of your chest, which wraps around your heart and goes around your esophagus. So when you get inflammation or gastritis in the stomach, when that acid builds up, it flares up that vagus nerve. That sends signals to the nerve going around the heart on the left side, and you get that typical palpitation or heartburn, as it's called.
Wow, symptom. That's so interesting. And is that why you could have people fainting if they have connected to, let's say, a discomfort in the stomach or something, or they haven't eaten, then they do, and then something...
So that's more like a vasovagal symptom. Mm-hmm. It could be related. They get that hollow, sharp pain in the stomach, and the vagus nerve is expressed at that point, but also sometimes they're dehydrated, so their blood pressure drops, and they could be fainting more from that.
Okay, so it could be for a number of reasons that is the case. Okay, who is, before we move on from this, who's at risk for these, for IBD, for Crohn's, colitis? What plays a role here?
So we definitely got to look at your risk or your genetics, okay? The Crohn's disease most chronically affects white populations, Caucasians, particularly those of European and North American distributional descent. It does occur across all racial groups, but the highest prevalence is in your Caucasians in Western countries. There is now a notable rising incidence amongst Black, Asian, and Hispanic populations as well. The severity shows that the more severe do present in the Black and Asian populations, but from a genetic risk point of view, the individuals of an Ashkenazi Jewish descent, have a higher risk for development of the disease. With regards to ulcerative colitis, it also commonly affects Caucasians, with the most highest risk in those of Ashkenazi Jewish descent.
That's interesting. So does that mean, you know, as our community is small and well, interbred, I don't know how else to put it,
isn't bread a problem with the colon?
Well, I don't know. I thought that's something else. But are we seeing higher incidence?
I don't think we're seeing high instances. As I say, I generally think we're just better at picking up these things.
Ah, okay. Can you have these with very, very mild symptoms?
You can. You can have Crohn's with very mild symptoms. You can have ulcerative colitis with mild symptoms. Generally, if it's not treated, though, they do progress.
Okay. Let's move on. Are you happy that we've covered what you wanted to cover in terms of IBD?
So I think we also got to discuss is that you do get what we call extra articular or extra intestinal symptoms, which is very important in inflammatory bowel disease. Now you ask yourself, why would you get other symptoms from this? That's because inflammatory bowel disease is a systemic disease. So in other words, it's an immune mediated disease. It doesn't just localize to the bowel, which causes immune cells to attack other parts of the body. So you get your joint symptoms, which are musculoskeletal. You get people presenting with arthritis, small joints, the spine, the back. They get something called an enthesitis, which is inflammation of the tendons. You get skin complications, wow, which are cutaneous things. And these are very significant. Something called an erythema nodosum, which is a painful red, violet-raised tendon nodule on the shins or the forearms. You get pyoderma gangrenosum, which is a very severe condition, which presents with small blisters or bumps that turn into deep, painful chronic ulcers. You get oral stomatitis, which is a dry cracking of the lips.
So this really, it doesn't just impact the gut. Yeah.
And the eyes. You get severe eye inflammation. You get a uveitis, which is inflammation inside the eye. You get episcleritis, which causes redness and burning and itching of the eye. You can get dry eye syndrome. So I think just bringing these up, the important thing is if you have inflammatory bowel disease, and you notice that you've got new painful bumps on your body, or you've got red blurry eyes, or persistent stiffness in your spine, or worsening swelling in the joints, you need to inform your gastroenterologist, because they need to up the treatment regime and change what's going on here.
A person, I know we're meant to move on to other subjects, but I'm just curious. A person with Crohn's or inflammatory bowel disease, how often would they typically need to see their medical professional?
So I think it's all dependent on how bad their disease is, what medication they're on. Are they on biological drugs? Are they on, you know, something called cilazoparine? Are they on different medications? What the effect is, have they got the extra intestinal side effects from the disease? So generally people see their gastroenterologist anything from 4 to 6 monthly.
Oh, wow.
But if they're well controlled, it can either be 6 monthly to once a year.
Okay, but you're not going every 5 years.
If you've got this, you're not going every 5 years.
Got it. That's really what I wanted to understand. Yeah. Let's talk about IBS. Common but miserable condition from what I'm understanding.
Yeah.
So I believe that it often gets dismissed as not being dangerous, but it can be debilitating. What are the causes?
So we start off saying that's a functional disease of your gastrointestinal symptom.
Right.
It's generally characterized by abdominal pain. You get bloating, irregular bowel movements. So basically everyone's got at the moment.
Mm.
You can get diarrhea, constipation. And the important thing to note is it doesn't damage your intestines or shorten your life expectancy, but the symptoms can definitively or severely impact your daily life. So the causes, we think that it's a disorder of your gut-brain interaction, where your digestive tract looks normal but doesn't function normally.
Right.
So you get abnormal, uncoordinated signals between the brain and the nerves in your digestive tract. There could be something called dysmotility, where your intestinal muscles contract too strongly or too weakly. There's some infections that can cause things like food poisoning or infections that can leave the gut permanently altered. You get SIBO, which is known as SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, where you get too much bacteria in the small intestine causing these symptoms. Early life stress, trauma, gut microbial changes. To note, though, and most important is that...
So literally finding a parking at Kosher World can cause IBS.
Yeah. Definitely.
Right, okay.
But you need to know that cancer or serious disease is not IBS. If it's very serious, it's not irritable bowel syndrome. So it may be uncomfortable, but if you're having severe symptoms with, like, as I say, blood in your stools, that type of thing, you're looking more for inflammatory bowel disease.
Right, okay, got it.
People with IBS may have food sensitivities, but it's not considered a real food allergy. It's an insensitivity. And we know what triggers the IBS flare-ups. So it generally varies from person to person. But
don't
we look
start with gluten.
Who said anything about that?
Fine, okay.
Maybe. Okay, so we look at the high FODMAP foods, okay? Yeah. Those are your fermentable sugars, like dairy, in inverted commas, gluten, your processed foods, your fried foods, your artificial sweeteners. Then things like stress. High stress levels can cause painful, unpredictable episodes. Hormonal changes. Many women notice that during their perimenopausal stages or their menstrual cycles. And then eating too fast or binge eating.
Okay, so there are many, many causes. I would imagine, though, that if somebody is suffering from this, that other things would need to be ruled out. It's almost like a diagnosis of exclusion,
yeah, but not.
That's what I would imagine.
So you've got to properly diagnose irritable bowel syndrome. You need a positive diagnosis based on your specific symptoms, and there's criteria we use called the Rome 4 criteria. So doctors use this to confirm if there's a functional diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome. And in order to be diagnosed with the Rome 4 criteria, you need to have recurrent abdominal pain at least one day a week for 3 months. Your symptoms have to have begun at least 6 months ago. And there's got to be an association with pain related to defecation, change in the frequency of stools, or a change in the form of the appearance of stools. And as you said, you use this to rule out your serious conditions because it can mimic these serious conditions. So it shares symptoms with a lot of serious conditions. And in order to do that, we've got to do certain blood tests. We look for things like celiac disease. We do stool tests. We do a fecal calprotectin to look for inflammatory bowel disease. You do a colonoscopy to see if there are any red flags. You know, I think we talk a lot about celiac disease or gluten, okay?
Yes, because celiac is the one reason you don't eat gluten.
So celiac, what happens with celiac disease is when you eat gluten, your immune system affects your small intestine lining, and it destroys, there's something called a finger-like projection in that thing, it's called villi, and that's responsible for your nutrients and absorption in that area. So it destroys that area. So that's why gluten's so important with regards to that. But in order to really differentiate IBS from IBD, which is irritable bowel from inflammatory bowel disease, you've got to know that your key differentiator is that fecal calprotectin test. You've got to look for your red flags. Is there unexplained weight loss? Is there rectal bleeding? Is there fever? Is there diarrhea or pain that wakes you up at night? Is there family history? Are you anemic? You've got to look for these. You've got to do a detailed history and exam. You can't just fob it off when someone's coming to you with like a sore stomach or sore stomach, because all too much, and I've had many patients that have come to see me because they've been to other practitioners with a sore stomach, they said, no, it's just stress, And unless you take a detailed symptom review and you check the blood, you do the stools, even with no red flags, then you're going to miss these things.
You know, I think often as parents, when we have teenagers, it's very difficult to know when not to take something seriously, but when to act further on it. What would a guide be?
So I think sometimes you've got to think like not being a parent and listen. It's about listening to complaints. So if your child complains every single day about a different thing, well, you won't take them too seriously. But if there's a recurrent pattern here, they're saying, you know, I've got severe stomach pain when I do this, or when I eat this, I've got pain, or I'm not able to pass stools at this stage, or when this happens, I feel like there's some acid in the back of my throat. You need to listen to the symptoms and understand, because even though we say stress conduit, stress can cause more reflux. It can cause acid. You have to listen to your children and understand what they're going through as well.
Carol wants to know, and she's really asking every question that I've wanted to ask. I mean, she's doing a fantastic job of this. But she wants to know, what are your thoughts on taking a probiotic every day in order to assist this?
So why are we taking the probiotic? Are we taking
a probiotic? I don't know, Carol. Why are you taking a probiotic? No, so it was Carol's question.
Carol, it's a very good question. Because
I wanted to ask.
Is taking something for every medical malady what we need to do or not? So if you eat a well-balanced diet and you eat enough nutrients and you've got good vegetables and good things and you generally don't have any stomach issues, possibly not. There's a lot of talk about your gut microbiome, and people do promote the use of probiotics. They used to say an apple a day keeps a doctor away. They now say a probiotic a day potentially also keeps a doctor away. It's possible. The gut microbiome, everything going on inside the gut, is a very important place for other medical issues to start. And as you see, we've spoken about the extra-intestinal things from inflammatory bowel disease. So I don't fault anybody that takes a probiotic a day. I don't think everybody has to, but I don't think it's a bad thing.
Is there are there good probiotics? And I'm not asking you to.
I'm not going to mention that. Probiotics. They're ones that have got good strains that help. Remember what happens is when you get a lot of disease in the stomach is you've got normal bacteria in your stomach. So if that bacteria in the stomach isn't formed well and it gets eaten away by too much acid or there's some other infection that causes that bacteria, which is protective for you to go away, sometimes you need to replace them with other sort of good bacteria. And in that case, you do need a probiotic.
And how would somebody, would your pharmacist know, is it important to ask your doctor what to take?
I think ask your healthcare practitioner, whoever that may be, what they advise for you and see from there. You know, you want somebody who's going to give you a balanced answer for what's good for you. Everyone varies accordingly.
It is 6:40. I'm Howard Feldman. We're going to take a quick break. I'm chatting to Anton Meiberg, Dr. Anton Meiberg, talking about gut health. We'll be back just after this.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 18:40. I'm Howard Feldman in conversation with Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're talking gut health. And I wanted to move on to the upper GI because you've now given us a sense of location, location, location.
Right.
And we want to talk about gastritis. And I don't know how to pronounce this. Is it GERD?
So it depends which continent you're on. Okay, it's either GERD or GORD. So if it's spelled esophagus with an E, then it's GERD. If esophagus is spelled as an OE, then it's GORD. It's the same thing. It's like migraine and migraine.
Okay, I thought that GORD was something we ate as a
siman
on Rosh Hashanah, but anyway, that's completely confusing. Okay, so let's talk about the upper gut. What are the common ailments here that we're going to be talking about? What are the symptoms? Let's go through those.
So the most common one is GERD, as you intimated. We always talk about gastritis. Mm. We'll talk about esophageal issues. But let's start with GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease. It's a chronic digestive condition where the stomach acid, which frequently flows into the esophagus, so it goes backwards, comes all the way up the stomach and goes into the esophagus. And some people get heartburn, but other people get atypical symptoms. And that's very important in my practice because a lot of the time that's missed. So someone will come to me with a chronic cough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually one of the top three causes of a persistent cough. They get a dry, hacking cough that lasts for a number of weeks. And they always mention that it's worse after a meal or at night when they go to bed.
Right.
And that's pathognomonic of gastroesophageal reflux. Okay. You can get people who have irritation of their throat or their larynx. They get a laryngitis. And that's picked up a lot of the time by the ENTs. When they're scoping patients in their rooms, they see that their larynx is swollen and they've got a laryngitis. And a lot of the time it's what we call a silent reflux disease. Hoarseness of the voice, because the stomach acid can inflame the vocal cords. You get a raspy voice. You can get what we call a globus sensation, where people present with a lump in the back of their throat, or they feel like food is stuck when there's no actual blockage. So going back to, I think it was Mavis, that could just be reflux.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's something to look for. A lot of the time, our dental colleagues pick it up because they see that there's unexplained erosion of the tooth enamel, or there's sensitivity caused by acid reaching into the mouth. And then from my side, from an asthma point of view, you get asthma-like symptoms. So a lot of my patients have got dual disease, because the airways are affected from the reflux. The acid spills up, comes up the esophagus and spills into the lungs and could cause a worsening of the wheezing and cause shortness of breath. So if you experience these symptoms, and especially they're worse after eating or lying down, then you need to see somebody. You need to see a specialist or your doctor or whoever you need to see, so someone can help you with understanding what's going on.
I remember when one of our kids were very, very young, they had constant heartburn. And at one stage, they were concerned that the cells in their esophagus were changing. What is that?
So that's something that's very important. That's called a Barrett's esophagus.
Right.
So that's a condition where your normal lining of your esophagus, your food pipe, is replaced by tissue that looks like the lining of the intestine. Because remember, your acid sits in your stomach and goes to your intestinal areas there. So that's a different cell lining to what you would find in your esophagus. And you get what we call a cellular change. So you get these white cells, these white, flat, pinkish cells that are found in the esophagus. They're called squamous cells. And they're replaced by columnar cells, which are tall red cells, which take the place when the acid reprograms the cells. So you get a reprogramming of the cells as a defense mechanism to the acid coming up into your esophagus due to the chronic damage from the stomach acid. And the only way to really diagnose that is on a gastroscopy. And you look for the gastroenterologist, look for what we call a salmon-colored tissue, and they take a biopsy to see what it is. But, I mean, you can say, so what? So it happens. What's the problem with that? The problem is it's a pre-malignant condition. It's a cancer precursor and increases your risk of developing esophageal, what we call adenocarcinoma, which is a very serious form of cancer. But through early detection, you can prevent this from happening, and you can do minimally invasive treatments to help with this. And things that really make it worse are smoking as well. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a family history with a first-degree relative with Barrett's esophageal cancer, you have to have regular scopes. So who would you screen? You'd screen people with chronic heartburn for a number of years, people over the age of 50, people with a family history, smokers, people with obesity. These are the people you worry about.
Right. And we often hear about H. pylori. What is it? How do we test for it? What is that about?
So H. pylori is one of the most famous bacteria that we deal with when it comes to gastrointestinal issues. It's a bacteria. Mm-hmm. It's a highly adaptive bacteria because it can survive in a very highly acidic environment in the stomach, and it produces an enzyme called urease that neutralizes the acid there. It causes a chronic inflammation, or we call it a gastritis, and most of the peptic ulcers we find in the stomach. And it can increase your risk for certain stomach cancers and a lymphoma called a mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue kind of cancer. The transmission, it spreads through person-to-person contact, right, via saliva, vomit, stools, and through contaminated foods. The most easy way to test for it is you can do a non-invasive or invasive methods, but you've got to stop, and this is the caveat, you've got to be really careful when you test for it, because there's certain things can actually interfere with the testing. So you've got to stop certain like antibiotics and what you call proton pump inhibitors before, 2 weeks before, so you can avoid a false negative test, and you do something called a urea breath test. That's the most common non-invasive, where you actually swallow a substance containing urea. And if that H. pylori is present, it breaks down the urea into labeled carbon dioxide, which is then measured when you exhale in your breath.
Right.
So it's, you know, a lot of my patients call, I've got the helicopter disease. Helicobacter, that's what it's called. It's a spiral shaped thing, but it is the helicopter. And it's a very easy to treat, but you have to treat it if you get it, because it can cause peptic ulcer disease. It can cause chronic gastritis. It can cause precancerous lesions. It can cause anemia. And you've got to treat it with either triple or what we call quadruple therapy for at least 10 to 14 days. And that consists of 2 or 3 antibiotics and a proton pump inhibitor to reduce the stomach acid.
Wow. Okay. And talking about ulcers, how big a risk are they?
So, once again, it depends what the cause of the ulcer is.
Right.
You've got to look at peptic ulcer disease, and you've got to look at gastric disease, and you've got to look at it. But peptic ulcers are very dangerous if they bleed. They can be very painful. They can cause irritation. They can cause a masking-like symptom like a type of a gastritis. And the problem is if they bleed, they can cause something called a melena, where you get a darkening of your stools, where you get blood in your stools and it's a dark, foul, pungent smelling odor that comes mm-hmm. out that's really so easy to pick up, and it causes major problems.
So and treat it? I mean, treat it. Ibuprofen, is that really a contributor to it?
Ibuprofen definitely is a contributor to it. Remember, just to say that you get a lot of overlap between your gastritis, which is inflammation in the stomach, and your peptic ulcer disease. So the one of the big causes of this is your Helicobacter pylori and your non-steroidal anti-inflammatory disease, your drugs. Those definitely can cause. And the reason why these your anti-inflammatories cause it is because they what we call cyclooxygenase inhibitors. So the cyclooxygenase.
Look, let's not make it my anti-inflammatories.
So I'll call your anti-inflammatories. Yeah, we call them my. COX-1 inhibitors, okay?
Oh, so maybe that's
so anti-inflammatories are COX-1 inhibitors.
Right.
And that prevents the release of prostaglandin to actually stabilize the smooth muscle there and release sort of acid in the stomach and causes your symptoms of your bloating, your burping, your fullness. You can even vomit up blood. You can black tarry stools, and you've got to have a lot of things to try and change the milieu of the situation there.
Before we go to a break, I just wanted to ask a quick. I don't know if it's a quick. It's a quick question, maybe not a quick answer. Lifestyle versus meds in terms of reflux.
So, what works and what doesn't work essentially? Okay, you've got to have a combination of lifestyle changes and medication. Weight loss is the most effective lifestyle change. Even a small change in your weight loss can provide a significant release for people seeing that with that. Your sleep positioning, you mentioned that earlier. So
yes.
Most people with severe reflux elevate the head of the bed by a minimum of like 15 to 20 centimeters, and they sleep on their left side to use gravity to keep the acid down. Some people don't even know that they're doing that,
yeah,
but they find it so much more comfortable. The other thing is having smaller meals throughout the day. And also avoiding food 2 to 3 hours before you lie down. Tobacco cessation, one of my favorites, because smoking, if you quit smoking, it improves the function of your lower esophageal sphincter. And then obviously your medications. Your medications like your proton pump inhibitors are highly effective at suppressing the acid buildup. But what people don't know is that you need to take your proton pump inhibitor half an hour before a meal, or 2 hours after the meal.
That is that covers that part of it.
Just want to say, everyone speaks about caffeine, chocolate, spicy foods. Those are very weak to say
really?
That they cause. So some people have a bit of a thing, but go for selective elimination. Don't just eliminate everything if you've got that.
I think that is very, very nice advice. I like that. And eliminate the coffee last. It is 18:51. I'm chatting to Dr. Anton Myberg. We're talking gut health. We'll be back just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 18:52. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Tonight we're talking gut health. We don't have a lot of time. That sounds terrible medically.
Jeez, Howard.
We don't.
1 year of medicine, now you're a doctor.
There we go. So, no, it's we don't really, it's only 8 minutes, but if you do have any questions, please send them in now, 061-895-1019. Let's talk about scopes. When do you do a scope? When do you do a gastroscope? When do you do a colonoscopy? And what are those great drugs that they use to put you to sleep because they're the best?
Okay, Michael Jackson, we're going to get there now. Right, so a gastroscopy, that's known as upper endoscopy.
Right.
Okay, that's we say you should have a scope when you've got concerning symptoms in your upper digestive tract, the throat, the stomach, the first part of the small intestine. So the red flags for that is, have you got difficulty swallowing? It's called dysphagia. Food feels like it's stuck in your throat. Have you got an unexplained weight loss? Are you vomiting blood? Do you have dark, tarry stools, persistent vomiting, severe persistent abdominal pain, and any new symptoms for people over the age of 50? And the common reasons we do the scopes is for chronic heartburn, unexplained anemia, chronic nausea, pain in your stomach, and we try and rule out things like ulcers, celiac disease, esophagitis, abnormal growths, and we monitor to check things like Barrett's disease, as we said earlier. The other reason to do gastroscopy is that we use it to stop bleeding from an ulcer or a blood vessel, to remove swallowed objects, or to stretch a narrowed esophagus. Now, with regards to colonoscopy, which is a completely different procedure,
right?
45 is the new 50 for colonoscopy.
I was going to say it to you, because do we need symptoms or do we just need to have survived
so
our certain number of years?
A person with an average risk, mm-hmm. they should start at age 45, and if everything is normal, then they can do it every 10 years. So we start to screen for colorectal cancer at from the age of 45. Mm-hmm. As I say, if the results are normal, then we only do it every 10 years until the age of 75. If you've got a family history with a first-degree relative, that means it's a parent or a sibling or a child who had colorectal cancer or polyps, then you start at the age of 40
mm-hmm.
or 10 years younger than the age when they were diagnosed, whichever comes first. In our high-risk groups, like individuals with inflammatory bowel disease or genetic syndromes, you may even start early and start scoping in their 20s or 30s. And once again, the reasons for scoping, we look at rectal bleeding, a change in bowel habits like diarrhea and constipation, unexplained weight loss, persistent abdominal pain or discomfort, iron deficiency anemia. You know, I've had a patient that came to see me for an iron deficiency anemia. That was his only symptom. He was just feeling tired. Checked his iron levels, and I said to him, this is not okay. We need to scope you. We found that he had cancer, and thank God this patient is doing extremely well. We caught it early.
It's unbelievable.
Had surgery. He had chemotherapy, and he's now in remission. And thank God, so you can catch these things very, very early, and they can be treated. But you've just got to know that 45 is the new 50. That's according to the American Cancer Society. You can use colonoscopy to prevent cancer. And interestingly enough, scoping is not generally recommended off the age of 85 because of individual risks and health. And you spoke right. about the Michael Jackson medication.
Is it really the same medication?
It's called propofol or Diprovan. It's a white, milky substance they use to induce anesthesia or to sedate you. And that's generally what's
but
given
that's
to people.
A proper sleep, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't wake, you just wake up chilled.
Yeah.
Like relaxed.
So I think also, you know, we're saying 45 is the new 50. The reason for this is because that's when you can detect your precancerous polyps, which is early. And it's shown to be extremely effective, that a single colonoscopy at that age can effectively reduce your colorectal cancer mortality by 65 to 70%.
It really is, you know. It's
look, not everything's also about scoping. You can also do other tests. There's the FIT, which is a fecal immunochemical test, which is done under stool. That can be done once a year to check if there's blood in your stool to check for colon cancer. That doesn't come with drugs, no.
Okay,
there's something called the Shield blood test, which is also non-invasive. So there are lots of good tests that are around that can help diagnose these things.
So just to be clear on it, so today if somebody is 45, they have never had a scope, what do they do? They go to their GP, they go to, do they go, what?
Look, I'm not trying to cause a line of people going for scopes from the age of 45, but if you're 45, and you've got stomach issues, or you've got a first-degree relative that's got stomach issues with regard to colorectal cancer or other cancers, then they should be seeing a gastroenterologist for a scope. People are very scared of scopes because of sedation and because of what the taste of the prep is that they'll be taking. Things have changed. There's massive differences in what things taste like. You get what we call the sedation, the nap, okay?
Yes.
People have a fear of not waking up. It doesn't really affect
people. No, and if you're
going
to choose
anymore.
To not wake up, that's a good way to not wake up because it's really nice.
Yeah.
But seriously, I think it is important that it actually isn't so. The way in which it's done is so non.
It's so non-90s. It's now 2026. Things are done much more effectively.
With respect, with dignity. You really, really don't feel.
Correct.
You really don't need to feel concerned. Craig is telling us we do need to wrap up. Finally, before I let you go, daily gut safety.
So that's important. Okay, chew thoroughly. You know, aim to at least 20 to 30 chews per bite to help with your digestion. Hydrate often, drink enough water, try and include yogurts or other foods, fermented foods, into your diet. Feed your bacteria in your stomach with asparagus or oats. Move your body. Take a 10 to 15 minute walk after a meal to support your digestion. Manage your stress properly. And then leave a few hours before bedtime after a meal. Aim for more vegetables. Reduce your processed foods and prioritize your sleep.
That is where we do need to leave it. An hour just really, really does move at an incredible, incredible rate. Unfortunately, we just received one or two more questions. We can't get to them. We'll see what we can do to answer you privately. But unfortunately, we do need to wrap up. Craig, thank you. As always, Craig keeps us on the straight and narrow. Make sure that we follow a very, very defined pattern. Dr. Anton Myberg, thank you. As always, we'll see you next week for another session of the Weekly Checkup.